Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Does it sound snobby?
Maybe like a little bit like, syntactually fascist or something.
That's good. I have never heard that combination.
I don't know if that's a word either.
Tactically.
I'm pretty sure fascist is a word, though.
Absolutely.
I like it.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. And I'm joined, as always, by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Also in studio, of course, is co-host and reporter Jacob McQuinney. Jacob, you're all dressed up for a school's guide presentation.
Yeah. We had a presentation this morning at the Linda Vista Library. Shout out to Jeff, the library manager, a longtime listener, and apparently knows you.
Yeah, I know him well, long time. He helped me. I did a little walking tour of Linda Vista. You know, Linda Vista, of course, was one of the neighborhoods set up by the federal government to handle San Diego's housing crisis.
Okay.
Frontier was the other one, and Frontier, mm-hmm. of course, was bulldozed and, eliminated. But Linda Vista is still there. All the churches they built, the old rec center for that housing development became Skate World and that shopping center there. So anyway, I did a little walking tour and Jeff helped me out a little bit with that.
Oh, that sounds fun. Wow.
Coming up on the show this week, the San Diego City Council voted to explore the creation of an enhanced infrastructure financing district. We know you're dying to understand what that is. We got you. A federal agency has been quiet about a broken sewage plant at the U.S. border for years. They're asking for funding to fix the plant, but they won't tell anyone what exactly is wrong with it. We'll explain what we do know and what Mackenzie Elmer got back when she asked for the document that lays it all out. Finally, as victims of the January flood scrambled to save their homes and feed their families, local government did what it often does best. It got caught in some red tape. Senior investigative reporter Will Huntsbury will join us to talk about his latest story of why it took local government so long to create a center for residents to get some help. It's going to be a good show. Stay with us. But first, we need to go through a few election updates. There were a couple close ones that we've been watching, and we have a major update in one of them, the 75th Assembly District. This is the one Carl DeMaio has the big lead in for first place, but who's going to go with him to the runoff has been a big question. DeMaio, of course, wanted the Democrat to go with him, Kevin Giusa. He spent money on Giusa's behalf, worked hard to try to make that possible because he knew that would be an easier race. He claims to be able to save the Republicans' money so they could get more gains in November across the state. But Andrew Hayes, who was endorsed by the Republican Party, And Hayes is also a school board member, and he's endorsed by the party. He's got all the support. Works for Brian Jones. Brian Jones has been really active to support him, Senator Brian Jones. And he has a 500-vote lead in the latest count to try to make it to that runoff against Kevin Giusa, or over Kevin Giusa. And that might hold. It lost a little ground. He was gaining tons of ground, and then he lost a little bit. So this is going to go right down to the wire about who goes that. I will say this. If it's DeMille versus Hayes, it is going to be crazy how mean and vile that race is going to get, because there will be Republicans and Democrats who want to go after DeMille, and then DeMille won't hold anything back going after Andrew Hayes, and they'll all spend a bunch of money, and it's just for a assembly seat to be in the minority party in Sacramento. But the people, like DeMille, has a very polarizing effect, obviously, and that's going to be a really interesting one.
It's like more drama. Give us all the drama.
So much drama.
I know this is not a new concept, right? Like, this is a thing that obviously candidates do. They want to pick their opponent.
Yeah, this is a shit thing.
But I don't know why lately I've just been thinking of this like one of those arcade games, like battle games, where you're like, pick your opponent or something. Like, I keep hearing those words in my head. But I mean, initially the numbers were sort of hinting at like, oh, he might have gotten his wish, right? Because Kevin was in second place. But
I think it was Politico who wrote, like, he's going to slide into the runoff facing a Democrat that he's very excited to have. But I think this was just another lesson that anything that's closed on election night, don't say anything about it. Like, don't make any big insights or observations about it, because it's just, it's very likely to change, or it has a very good chance of changing.
Yeah.
Another one, San Diego City Council, District 3. Stephen Whitburn, the incumbent, will run against Colleen Cusack. She's an attorney well known for representing people on the streets, homeless individuals, other people with minor infractions and such. So that is a much different race than were he to run against the former journalist who's much more active in the neighborhood preservation movement. We like things how they are, maybe a little bit different, but not that much. We are going to have a quick cameo from a very special person. Our new social media producer is in the house, in the studio. Super excited to announce Bella Ross is here. She was a member of the editorial board at the Union Tribune that endorsed Colleen Cusack. A lot of us saw that and were a little bit surprised. Not that they didn't endorse Stephen Whitburn. Whitburn has a lot of foes, it might be said, and it could, you know, I can understand why you wouldn't want to endorse him, but you guys chose to endorse Cusack. Do you have any insight as to why that happened?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was very clear from the beginning of the conversations, and I was not there the first time we endorsed Whitburn, but from what I've been told and what I read, it was a pretty lukewarm endorsement. It was not, I don't think we were, as an editorial board, really crazy about him from the start, but going into those conversations, there was a lot of openness to the fact that, you know, we've seen a lot of stuff from Whitburn that a lot of people, myself included, didn't really like, especially when it comes to the camping ban. And that kind of attitude towards homelessness just wasn't resonating with us. And I know it doesn't with a lot of the community. And so when we were thinking about a challenger for that race, you have Colleen Cusack, who's really associated with the homeless population, representing the homeless population, and Kate Callan, who's standing with neighborhoods, we were really thinking, like, what voice really needs to be represented on the council more right now in this moment? And to me, that clearly seemed to be homeless people versus homeowners, who have been represented on every government body, overrepresented forever, for all of time. And so I think that was really the thinking going into it. And, you know, reality is that would be a really tough race for somebody like her to win. But, you know, these endorsements can go a long way, I think, in at least shaping how people think about these races. Maybe not as much how they actually vote.
Yeah, I mean, Whitburn has a really good chance of being reelected. But who he runs against for the next few months will definitely frame how some of these questions go, how some of these conversations go. And that's an impact.
Yeah, I think it'll definitely push him in an interesting direction. Like, I think about the mayoral race, you have, like, Todd Gloria on Larry Turner, like, that's going to get pushed now because of that opponent. in a direction where they're probably going to be moving to the right. One, he's going to have to be stricter on homelessness if you're competing against somebody like Larry Turner.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see the opposite effect in this race with Stephen Whippern and Colleen Cusack. So it's going to be a really interesting kind of dichotomy that we're seeing between those two races.
Awesome. Well, I know that the staff is stoked that you're here. I'm stoked that you're here. I've been kind of taking a break from social media, and I want you to get me fired up again about it. All right?
Yeah. Follow us on social media. We're going to be doing some interesting stuff.
Let's go.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. Follow all those feeds at Voice of San Diego. That's just straightforward for every one of the major platforms, right? Speaking of Larry Turner, we do have a major update about that. Last week, of course, we talked about the lawsuit against the city for allowing him on the ballot, saying he didn't actually live within city limits when he put forward the paper to become mayor, to be eligible to be mayor. And the case was the sort of first argument of the case was put in. It was supposed to go to trial at the end of this month, but the plaintiff, a woman named Shelley Van Diver, decided she didn't want to do it anymore. She gave me a statement. She said, "My hope from the start was that the court would disqualify Mr. Turner from the ballot prior to the primary. This case was driven by a need to hold our democracy accountable and preserve our political processes locally. However, it's taken a real toll on me and my family members who have nothing to do with this case, yet have also been subjected to harassment by Mr. Turner's supporters. I trust that the voters will reject Mr. Turner's disingenuous campaign and hope the media will hold him accountable and find the true answer to the important questions posed by this case." So I followed up. I'm like, "You still think the case has merit?" And she's like, "Absolutely." Her attorney, Bob Ottley, who has, again, some experience in the past throwing candidates out, he said, "This is without question the most overwhelmingly clear domicile case I have ever seen in 40 years looking at this kind of cases." Except that he's not going to pursue it with her. So then the question was, would somebody else pick it up? Genevieve Jones Wright, the public interest attorney, civil rights attorney, former public defender who ran, who was third place, who would be the one to benefit if Turner gets thrown off the runoff. She said, quote, "While I'm aware of a legal challenge between the top two candidates, I want to make clear that I do not wish to substitute the voters' decisions with that of a judge." So unless somebody else picks it up, he's in, she's out, and it'll be Turner versus Gloria for the mayor's office in November.
I mean, what do you think the rationale behind nobody picking it up is? It seems kind of crazy that somebody would just leave it lying there, especially given all of the confidence that we've heard expressed that it was kind of a home run case.
I mean, but is it like if enough people voted for him to be in second place, like, do they even care that he didn't live here, you know, allegedly didn't live here when he filed documents, but now he does live here?
Fair enough. We if enough people voted for, you know, Elon Musk for mayor, then despite the fact that he didn't live here, but then decided to maybe buy a house here, it's the same kind of argument,
yeah.
You know.
I think the mayor's team has probably, or his friends have probably decided like that they don't need the hassle of being seen like they're trying to throw him out.
Yeah.
They might prefer to run against him for some reason over Genevieve Jones Wright. And there's also just the issue of you do need somebody to stand up. And if the most interested person in that happening is Genevieve Jones Wright, because she'd be the one to take the spot and she doesn't want to do it, then who else is that interested in it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally no one, right?
Can it be anybody in San Diego?
Yeah, go for it.
Go for it, Jacob. Do you dare me?
Be ready, though. Be ready for
yeah, I mean,
for all the drama.
You might get subpoenaed.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if you were in a position where you're like, I might want to be the person who brings it forward, like, it's probably just a lot of hassle.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Mike Aguirre, the attorney for Larry Turner, did. You know, he wanted to depose a lot of people, wanted to get a lot of documents, and a lot of them were like, I'd rather not. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the core motivations behind that. Now, I think there's a really interesting thing happening in this race. The police officers have been really active in this last election. They wanted Hayes to beat to get into the runoff so he could beat DeMaio in that assembly race. They wanted Terry Hoskins to get to the runoff so that he could challenge Shawnee Lo Rivera, the council president, in November. They wanted Stephen Whitburn to get to the runoff and win his reelection. They got that. They wanted Monica Montgomery Stepps, chief of staff, to not win that seat in the District 4 City Council. They failed in that one, but they were very vocal about it. Now they're ready to go hard after Shawnee Lo Rivera in the runoff, but they have not said a word about Larry Turner. And Larry Turner is an actual active cop, police officer right now.
Terry's retired.
And the Police Officers Association have not said a word about supporting one of their own right now in the mayor's race. I think that's fascinating. I don't know if they're afraid that it'll make it worse or if they've got some other beef or if they're just like, you know,
he's just like constantly stealing people's lunches, you know, developed a real bad rep as the lunch thief.
But maybe, yeah, it's like the they have to put labels on all their drinks in the fridge. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. You think they just don't want to make enemies out of either one?
I don't think they're a fan for some reason. Hmm. I don't think they want to help him.
I mean, it is kind of a bad look for a cop to be, if the domicile stuff is true, kind of a bad look for a cop to be breaking the law in such a brazen manner.
Leave it at that.
Okay. I've been thinking about it, though. I don't think I'm going to pick it up, the case. I'm really busy right now.
You thought about it in the last minute.
Yeah, you know.
He's been thinking about it since.
I have class on Tuesday nights. Seems like,
and then you
I
have morning report duties.
I have morning report.
You got to find a song of the week.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Tuesday's a pretty busy day. Maybe if they could just do things on Wednesday, I'd be open to it.
Lastly, we did talk about there being a chance that Andrea Cardenas, who resigned as a city councilwoman in District 4 in Chula Vista after she was indicted and pled guilty to grand theft of PPP loan funds from the federal government.
It's going to be like a new video game. Grand Theft PPP. You got to really fill out this form and pick a business to collect those employees. Yeah. I've never played that game.
It's like
game
a dramatic
life.
Moment where you hit send on the application.
So good. Whoever makes video games out there.
Yeah, and you get the money and you have to determine what to spend it on.
Uh-huh.
Campaign.
She was close to getting a chance to get the runoff, but again, got to look at those updated totals. She has now fallen to fifth place. Top two, of course, go on to the runoff. She had resigned her seat, but was willing to serve again if the voters elected her. She appears to be completely out now. School board trustee Cesar Fernandez and former city council member Rudy Ramirez are in the top spots for now to go to the runoff. Well, it looks like we're going to create a new segment here at the Voice of San Diego podcast that we are all contributing to. It's not just about me, called I Can Explain That. I Can Explain That. I was reading the newspaper the other day. And
As one does.
And I have it here.
As not many do. You were reading the physical paper.
I was reading the physical paper, and I realized that a lot of people would not understand this paragraph of a story that I found very interesting, which was about the Midway Rising project in Midway. They're going to create thousands of units of housing, the new arena, all kinds of stuff. There was a blitz of rumor that they were going to try to get a hockey team. Did you see that?
I did.
And that's not going to happen. Stop. You all need to stop. There's no hockey team coming here other than the one that exists.
What are your thoughts about the G League San Diego Clippers?
It's cute. It's adorable that this town got excited about a minor league basketball team.
I don't like to be patronized like that, Scott. We have so little.
Here was the news from Jennifer Van Grove in the Union Tribune, front page of the Union Tribune on Wednesday, March 13th. Monday, San Diego City Council members voted unanimously to explore the formation of what's known as an infrastructure financing district, an enhanced infrastructure financing district. The action means the city and its real estate consultant will take a closer look at the pros and cons of creating a tax increment financing district to pay for public infrastructure in and around the project areas.
Sensing a lot of financing, sensing a lot of districts.
Yeah, so There was one phrase in there that's crucial to understanding this news.
Enhanced infrastructure financing district?
No.
Okay.
A tax increment financing district.
Oh, okay.
That's the phrase that you need to understand. All right, so let's get into this. So the idea is that they're going to draw a line at what the property tax revenues are from this 50 acres of land, nearly 50 acres of land that the city owns in that area right now.
So basically you can imagine there's a number on a whiteboard. They're going to circle that number and hold on to it there, right?
Yeah, that all of those property taxes that are generated by like the Phil's Barbecue and whatever else, that those are going to go to the places they already go all the time. It's just going to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But from this point forward, when they build stuff and it creates more property tax revenue, if they pass this, if it generates more property tax revenue for the county and the city, that money will be reinvested in the project itself, in the area around the project as well.
So anything above this number that we have circled.
And the anything above is called increment. So whenever you hear tax increment, what they're talking about is what's above the tax as it is now,
mm-hmm.
right? And so a lot of people, like the UT has this big headline, it says Midway Rising may get subsidy. And it had this like whiff of scandal that like, oh no, they're begging for government money to do this thing that we thought they were just going to do on their own, right? Mm-hmm. And so people who know this will remember this from redevelopment. Petco Park, for example. Petco Park was built with about $300 million of this kind of thing. So what they did is they drew a line a long time ago around downtown and said, it's blighted, it's horrible here. We need to do redevelopment here. And what they borrowed a bunch of money and they gave that money to developers to build things. They gave loans, they built parks, they built fire stations, they built all kinds of stuff. And the idea being that that would attract more construction and that construction would create more property tax revenue. And that property tax revenue could be used to pay off all the things they borrowed money for, mm-hmm. including Petco Park. They borrowed that $300 million. They're paying it off with the increase in revenue that they got from the property taxes that were created by people building things around property Petco Park, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's a similar thing that they want to do here, except it's not redevelopment, and it's much different. Redevelopment also made sure that increase in property tax revenue didn't go to the county, stayed in the area, didn't go to the city, stayed in the area, and didn't go to school districts, stayed in that blighted area.
This new financing district is kind of like the spiritual successor of
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So the state, when they got rid of redevelopment, they, a couple of years later, did this thing and said, well, you can still do these infrastructure financing districts. And that's what this would be. And mm-hmm. so they would draw a line around an area, stop the property tax that's going in and say that keeps going to where it's going. Anything above that, we can keep in this area. You can borrow money and build things with the borrowed money. Infrastructure, there's a list of things you can build, like parks, sewers, you know, roads. You can take care of like pollution. You can support affordable housing. And so the Chargers had this idea they were going to do one of these things for Mission Valley when they wanted to build a stadium.
Thank God we got rid of those losers.
the 49ers, the stadium in Santa Clara, they built that using in part this an infrastructure district like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but when this news came out that this was what they were going to pursue, there was this whiff of scandal around
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it too. It was like, man, I didn't know they were going to do one of these. That is a subsidy. Like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
But you look up all three of the bidders for this job said that they would need a similar infrastructure financing district to pull it off. It helps to understand what's actually happening here. The city agreed to begin negotiations with Midway Rising, the developers at Chelsea Investment Corp and Zephyr and Legends, this group that got together as Midway Village or
Midway Rising.
Midway Rising. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Got together as Midway Rising. The city agreed to negotiate a proposal with them. And and is providing updates along the way. Mm-hmm. The city will consider eventually a proposal, a full package of what it's going to do, and then the city council can up or down vote that. What happened this week was that they had an update to how those negotiations are going, and the city council endorsed the idea of pursuing or thinking about creating one of these districts.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting because when you start to understand that the, for example, rendering that was created was so far ahead of any of the actual decisions of what actually is going to be there, you realize that it is just kind of this pipe dream, this like hazy mirage of what could years later one day appear on this site.
Yeah, I think that's
quite beautiful.
It is, sure. Yeah, it's beautiful.
We love renderings here.
Yeah.
I almost used it, and that was what stopped me for the morning report. I was like, it's probably not going to look anything like this.
Yeah, no, I mean, renderings can be beautiful in the same way that, like, if you're walking in the desert and you're dying of thirst and you see the mirage of an oasis in the distance, that is also beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's the big lesson of this, right? Uh-huh. That they, all of these groups and the three finalists put together renderings, numbers of units they want to build, the type of arena they're going to build, and uh-huh. all of it was fake. All of it. It was just like, this is how good we are at presentations and all of the things we could do. And they all wanted the chance to get what Midway Rising got, which was their foot in the door to go through this process and, you know, change their minds about different things and, you know, ask for different things along the way and realize like this is how it's going to go so that they can hammer out agreement. But all based on the idea that you go along through that process and you're going to be so far along at some point that the city council is probably not going to be willing to say like, okay, we're going to start all over.
Yeah.
There's a whole sunk cost situation here. Like you are in. And the city council is in.
It's been years. We've been going back and forth. There's been money spent on all this. I mean, why turn back now? Let's just keep moving forward with whatever flawed reality we have. Not necessarily that's the case. Not necessarily saying that's the case here, but that is essentially the fallacy here.
And remind us why they decided to do that. To say we're going to pick this group and only negotiate with them as opposed to considering other groups.
Why they wanted to be exclusive with Midway Rising?
Mm-hmm. Exclusivity.
The Midway Rising group proposed the largest number of affordable housing units. Mm. And they cut back on the middle income units that they proposed and the hotel that they were going to build, but they've held to that affordable housing. And all affordable housing is subsidized by taxpayers, right? The tax credits that they get, the fees that come in and other things that subsidize affordable housing. So it was all of them were depending on some sort of subsidy. And I think that what they did promise was this largest number. I think they've held toward that, but they're saying like, this is the kind of stuff we're going to need to do to be able to create a better transit connection to Old Town, all kinds of stuff to make this work. And again, all three of those final bidders had some version of an infrastructure financing district, this sort of tax increment collection in their plan.
So I have questions.
Yes.
Is this something that this district exists into eternity, or does this wear off at some point and then city, county, schools all of a sudden get the benefit of this new tax money that's been created through this financing district?
Yeah. So one thing, remember that schools are not a part of this. They, mm-hmm. if there is increased property tax created by this infrastructure district, schools would still get that.
Oh, okay.
It's not like redevelopment where schools also suffered. Mm. I think that was part of the thinking is like that made it really politically hard to keep doing this because schools need money. Schools make up about 50% of who gets the property tax. So it's still, it takes a huge chunk out of the consideration for that sort of tax increment. And it has a limit of 45 years. So eventually, they'll probably come to a shorter agreement, but let's say they figure out that X project's gonna deliver this much revenue per year in property taxes. They can translate that into how much money they could borrow now, use that borrowing to build like, you know, whatever sewer or bus line or whatever they're going to do to make it work or park. and then pay that off with the money that comes in from that increment.
Got it. Got it. So to be clear, even if they pass this thing, if these property taxes increase, schools still get to benefit from that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean, that's a relief given the fact that there would be thousands of new units and presumably at least hundreds of kids to these local schools, which will inevitably, I'm sure, create infrastructure problems at those schools.
Right.
All right, Scott. Well, I deem by the power vested in me that you've explained that.
Thank you.
You want to know something that'll just like cheer up your heart? Well, the story published on Tuesday,
yeah. But
obviously it ran in the paper the next day. And Jacob and I were messaging each other about it for the morning report. And I was like, I have no idea what any of this means. Like, let's just wait tomorrow for Scott to explain.
And I got it wrong kind of, because I was like, I was surprised by it, yeah. To the extent I'm like, I never realized they were proposing something like this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, did they just bait and switch us? And I look back at the reports and it was super clear that all three of the proposers were going to suggest something like this. I mean, even La Prensa was in there saying like, here's what La Prensa wrote. None of the three proposals, including Termini's, that's the Midway Rising, mentioned that they would seek public financing when they presented their projects in 2022. And then the UT has Midway Rising may get subsidy, like this big thing, like it's mm-hmm. a big surprise. They all three very clearly planned on doing something like this.
But so, it was such a, it's like the kind of word you just glance over.
Yeah, I'm exactly. I'm going to give myself a break that I didn't notice EIFD.
EIFD.
You know, even as nerdy as I am on that. So thank you.
So often, you know, our reporters will be watching a meeting or, you know, keeping tabs on something that they've been covering. And Mackenzie Elmer, our environment reporter, and as some refer to her, a catastrophes reporter.
Earth, wind, and fire.
Yes. We should get a tote with that for her. She has been writing for a very long time about the Tijuana River sewage crisis. And I can't remember when this was because time is not real, but she wrote a story about a sewage treatment plant along the U.S.-Mexico border that we've known was broken and needed some repairs. And in fact, members who oversee that sewage treatment plant were, you know, advocating for money to improve it.
But, just some context. So this is this big plant.
Yeah. I can't even picture it in my head, though. But yes, describe
it. It's along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's on the north side. It's in that valley between Tijuana and San Diego. And it's a big facility. And it has a pipe that goes really far out into the ocean underneath there. It's actually good fishing along that pipe. But that is that is owned by both Mexico and the United States, and managed under that sort of International Border Water Commission. Both countries have representatives on this, and it's important. It doesn't solve any of the major problems for why like the sewage is flowing into the ocean, but it does a big part of the treatment of what exists of sewage collection in Tijuana, and it not working is kind of a big deal.
Means it's throwing just dirty
poop
water into the ocean, not yes. cleaned. And so she reported that not only was this plant, you know, broken and needed repairs, but like it was in fact even more broken than we thought. And it needed the money it had gotten to do some improvements was actually money it needed to fix some of the broken stuff, and it'll still need much more money. And so she was following updates on this plant. And in those updates, staff kept referring to like this study that was done. And, you know, classic reporters are like, oh, I got to get my hands on this study. And naturally, she reached out to the International Boundary and Water Commission, IBWC, very fun name, and asked for this report. And, you know, they were basically ignoring her, didn't respond. And eventually we decided that we were going to sue for this public record that we had requested, and they were refusing to give us.
We sue often on state stuff, on
yes.
California stuff, and we've only done it a couple times on federal stuff. So this is a federal Freedom of Information Act violation that we're alleging and sued on.
Yes. And we got something. And Mackenzie's in her desk, sitting down in her desk. And she calls me over and she's like, look at what I got. This is ridiculous. And she's scrolling. And all I see is like a blob of black because this study that they sent her, because we sued them for it, is just incredibly redacted. It's so redacted that even like the index pages are redacted. So there is absolutely no way to know what this study found about the state of this broken sewage treatment plant.
It's hilarious. Yeah. Parts of the table of contents are redacted.
yeah interrupted. No, she wrote, I could tell the agency looked carefully at every pump station, sludge tank, and grit chamber, but all the information about what's wrong with each piece of machinery and what they plan to do about it is blacked out. And it's just page after page of black.
And we're not the only ones who want to know what the status of this plant is. Obviously, because they're requesting money from the federal government to fix it. And then representatives only to find out that, oh, it's actually more broken than we thought and said it was broken. Here's a quote from Representative Dara Issa's spokesperson who said, quote, what we've received so far from the IBWC demonstrates no transparency of the project's past, present, and future, and no coherent plan for how this gets done. They didn't disclose the deferred maintenance and sent us a bill saying time out is the least we can do in the public interest. So even the people that they're requesting money from don't know, or, you know.
It is very wild. It's like taking your car to the mechanic and getting a call back from the mechanic saying, yeah, you need to pay twice as much for me to fix your car. And when you ask them what's broken, they say, I'm not going to tell you, but it's expensive.
and here's the bill.
Yeah.
get going with it. So that's where we're at. I believe Mackenzie is still obviously trying to get more information from the report.
Well, so remember everybody was super excited to get about $300 million to help with infrastructure around sewage in this area and at this plant. And that's the money that they're like, okay, we got $300 million. And then they found out that not only could it not improve things, it had to fix the old problem. And the whole problem now is $600 million or more. Mm-hmm. And so it just barely even made a dent.
And the hope was to get that $300 million and expand what the plant is doing to clean more water. And so they get this money and they say, no, we can't do any of the expansion. This all just has to go to this backlog of repairs for this busted ass plant. Yeah.
And then maybe in the future, after a bunch of millions of dollars, we can expand to clean more water.
It's pretty wild.
Well, Mackenzie's been following that saga for a long time. You can see her reporting and get her newsletter at vosd.org/MAC, MACK.
Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com.
I think after the January 22nd flood, something happened that we didn't really notice because it felt natural, but looking back is kind of surprising. And that is that January 22nd floods happen, but then a few days later, the YMCA in southeastern San Diego, the Jackie Robinson YMCA becomes like the center of support for the survivors of the flood, the people who had been dislocated and otherwise suffered because of what happened. And I think a lot of us just naturally thought, oh, that makes sense. That's a big place. And it's the Y has this like quasi-government presence. In my hometown, we had rec centers that were very important and had all the things that most things here are Y-centric, right? The Y does it. And then over time, I think we all realized like, wait, that was a little weird. And you picked up on that. And the Y obviously showed a lot of leadership. A lot of nonprofits showed leadership. But what was going on? And you ended up doing a story about this. Will Huntsbury is in the studio. Welcome.
Yes. Hello.
What did you find?
Mackenzie and I went to the Y couple weeks after the floods. I actually wasn't here the week of the flood, so I'd gotten back from vacation. Obviously, the floods were really terrible. We go over to the Y, and it's just like humming. There's so many people there, and it became a beloved presence, really. I mean, all these flood survivors felt super connected there, and you went in, and they had intake counselors, and you went up to an intake counselor, and that person could help you get a hotel room, could help you get like Cal Fresh, could help you get all these things. You go there, you could take a shower. Like, it was really nice. But like immediately all the people running it were like, we just keep wondering why we're doing this. And they were also like, we can't keep doing this. And they were also like, we're not trained in disaster response. You know, that's not what the Y does. They do youth services. And so that kind of sent me on a quest to answer that question of like, why?
There were other nonprofits that stood up too, right?
Yeah, yes. It was. So it wasn't just the Y. I talked to a guy a few times named Armand Harvey, and he's lived in Southeast San Diego his whole life. His family has a nonprofit called the Harvey Family Foundation. They were involved. At least five other different local nonprofits were involved. There were people providing tech support. There were nonprofits sending out volunteers to do mold remediation in people's houses, demolition.
Federation got really involved, right? Trying to figure things out.
Totally, totally. Yes. Yeah, so it was just this conglomerate of very local organizations. You know, all of those organizations involved had strong ties to Southeast San Diego. So, you know, as you talk to flood survivors, they just like, why, like, we all relied on each other. And there is such hope and resilience in that on the one hand. And, you know, they also had expected that government would do it. And they expected it on the one hand, but also, they live in the most underserved community in San Diego, so they were also like not shocked at all.
Mm-hmm. So, where was government?
Well, that was a question. That was what I wanted to figure out. And so, you know, the first thing I started looking to was wildfires. I was like, what usually happens after a wildfire, right? And government does stuff. What is it they do? And one thing they do is they normally set up a local assistance center that functions much like the Y was functioning in this case. And you can go there. There's an intake counselor. You get directed towards whatever type of service you might need. And so I started trying to figure. And so a couple of those were opened in the aftermath of the flood. The county opened one 6 or 8 days after the floods, but it was out in Spring Valley. So it wasn't near the epicenter of these floods. One did finally open in the epicenter, but it was like 12 days after the flood. Mm. And so I got some emails back and forth from the county and the city, and they showed that the county and the city were basically jockeying over whose role it was to set up this local assistance center.
And not in the way where like one wants to do it and the other one's like, no. They're both like, no, it's your job. And they're like, no, it's your job. No.
Exactly. Yes.
We'll help. Mm-hmm. We like provide services, but so, like, you got to set it up.
It was, you guys do it. No, you guys do it. No, I'm pretty sure you guys are supposed to do it. And, you know, there was this other bureaucratic thing where if cities want counties help in this kind of thing, they have to submit a request through this emergency web portal. I mean, you know, it has been around for many decades. Cities are very familiar with using it. The city had...
In other words, you have to file the right TPS report, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of comes down to that. And the city's like, we've been making verbal requests for a local assistance center. And the county's like, you need to make it through the web portal. And then they finally make it through the web portal on January 30th, 8 days after. But even then, the bigger issue is not the web portal, not web portal. The biggest issue is like the city's like, county, you need to set it up. And the county's like, no, you set it up and we'll send some support staff over there. And I'm not sure they've figured out this whole thing yet, because the spokespeople I talked to were still kind of insisting it was the other one's role.
Mm-hmm. This last line in your story is hilarious. Nicole Darling, or last couple lines. Nicole Darling, a spokeswoman for the city, continued to maintain that it was the county's role to set up a local assistance center within the city limits. Michael Workman, the county spokesman, was adamant that the responsibility of setting up an assistance center within city limits falls to the city. So even after all of these days, these lessons that they should have learned, it seems like they still don't have the procedure straight.
No, and they kind of know what was going on at the Y, and the people who set up the Y have been talking to them and saying, you need to get a plan in place. Mm-hmm. And you know, that, so those conversations are ongoing with the county and the city, and how is this supposed to go in the future? But I, you know, governments are always talking about how conversations are ongoing. And yeah, this is the best I got, that they have not come to an agreement about whose role it was.
It's just fascinating. I mean, we watched press conferences where Mayor Todd Gloria was like, this is going to happen again. This is going to be like a norm. Like, we're going to experience another storm like this. It's like, okay, cool.
Well, not only did he say that, he said we couldn't have done anything about this storm because it was too much water.
Yes.
And it's going to keep happening because of climate change. And so it's just like, this is just the reality. And they can't seem to articulate exactly how they're going to ever respond when it does.
Right. Mm-hmm. No. I initially had asked the mayor's staff for comment, but then the mayor's staff pointed me to the city emergency department, and then I ended up getting a quote from Nicole Darling.
And that's the perfect segue to, I think, what I would want to say. These are very staff-driven organizations, right? There's tons of people who work in these places. And staff in governments are... they are built to be afraid of rules and to understand rules and to understand liability concerns and limitations.
Procedures.
Their lives are governed by limitations. And a lot of those limitations are in place for important reasons, right? But those limitations in situations like this are not the best thing to focus on, right? And that's why whenever there's a fire or whenever there's usually some sort of situation like that, there's always a political leader who steps up and is like, no, let's get this done. And they make connections. They try to like push the staff to their limits. They try to figure out different things, connect dots that weren't being done. And sometimes they get in the way, but sometimes they actually facilitate that sort of leadership. And if that's what the overwhelming sense I get from this catastrophe was, is that there wasn't somebody who really acted in that capacity, from the mayor to the county supervisors or anybody. There was nobody that sort of stepped up and said, these are, you know, who cares whose job it is to do this? What are we going to do to get a disaster center set up, a local assistance center set up now? Totally. And we'll figure it out. And I think like that's what's so interesting, because you do have that exchange. And it's so funny how these exchanges go. Like the letter from the county to the city is like, you know, we have a long history of working together. I love you. You guys are really good at doing things. And then there's one, there's always one paragraph that's like, but you didn't fill out the right form. And it sounds like you're saying, well, you want us to move our operation that we have going to another place, but you don't have the place. And then the city one is like, we like working with you too, but you know, what about this? Like, what about you just do this for us?
It's like the most catty interaction.
Yeah. It's just like, and I think like at the heart of it are people are suffering.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of the Hep A crisis. This disease spreads throughout the streets of San Diego. People are dying. And the county and the city are like, you didn't give me a permit for like, you know, hand washing stations. And it's just like, well, you don't need a permit. You do need a permit. And it's just like, stop. And then once we did a story about it, they finally like they kicked into action. They got stuff done because there was a political leader that finally like woke up.
Yeah.
And
who was that?
It was Kevin Faulkner that year. And you know, I think in COVID we saw Nathan Fletcher and Kevin Faulkner kind of jockey of who was going to be the, you know, the leader, you know, making connections and stuff during that time.
Right.
And I think like, you know, each one of these, you see something like that come up and it just didn't happen that time.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, I had a long conversation with Workman, the county spokesman, and he said it happens different for different emergencies too, you know, because if the city and the county were here, they'd both certainly be saying, oh, but we did things. And they did. They both did plenty of things. But when it comes to this local assistance center, obviously the gears just ground to a halt. But the county, like, they open up a kind of emergency operating headquarters, not for victims and survivors to go to, but for them to pull the strings and manage things. And I'm pretty sure there was a county supervisor there. Workman said there generally always is. And sometimes that person is kind of just there listening to the different departments give updates and say what they're working on. And then I think sometimes you have a leader step in and actually try to manage it. And yeah, I'm sure that once the press gets on it, if the emergency's still in progress, that would have the effect of like somebody stepping up. In this case, we're now into the slow rolling disaster phase rather than the urgent one. So it's a little different.
So what was the response of the survivors of the flood that you spoke to? I mean, was there frustration? Did it feel like, you know, from what you heard from them, that they expected that the fact that they were an underserved community had any role to play in this?
Oh yeah. I mean, they thought that, you know, years of historic under investment in their communities was just being carried on in this flood response, mm-hmm. and that this was more of the same. And I think, you know, it's a lot of people are traumatized from that flood. I mean, you know, cars were floating, people were swimming with them, babies were being carried over their heads. It's a very traumatic event. And to have a traumatic event like that and feel like your government has basically kept you last in line forever and is continuing to keep you last in line, that has led to just an explosion of feelings in many people, and it's obviously very understandable.
You had this quote in your story from Armin Harvey, the nonprofit leader you mentioned earlier, who said, quote, "We have built the infrastructure together to be able to deal with this when the county and city and them have not been able to do it. You're allowing the community to do it for you guys, and that should be embarrassing." It's a good quote.
Yeah, it's a good quote. And the more I have dealt with this story, the more I feel the only way for the city or the county to get back on track with these survivors would be to have some sort of like truth and reconciliation situation, like where, you know, step one, you hear everybody out, you take it on the chin, you say, "I'm sorry, we did screw it up." And then you go from there. And, you know, governments are just shockingly unlikely to do those kind of sessions. You know, at least here in San Diego, we just see people again and again saying, "No, look at everything we did. No, look at everything we did." And if that's your starting place, you're not going to make any ground with these flood survivors.
Well, it's a great story about nonprofits stepping up and showing leadership, and just some of this back office sort of disagreement and lack of communication that was going on. You can check it out at vosd.org/Will. Thanks, Will.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in San Diego that has a new segment called I Can Explain That. It's the most popular podcast that has that. Get the newsletter for this podcast with more links, show notes, and updates from the Voice team at vosd.org/newsletters. That's vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez Villafana is Managing Editor. Jacob McQuinney is our education reporter. Nate John's our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.